Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, structure fire on 800 block of H Street in Eureka last Saturday. Two arrested during Eureka ICE protest last weekend. Man arrested for multiple firearm violations in Myers Flat. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
On Saturday, January 31st, 2026, around 1:20 a.m., the Humboldt Bay Fire Department received a call about a structure fire on the 800 block of H Street in Eureka. According to the press release, quote, Battalion 8104 was the first arriving unit and found smoke coming from a two-story multi-unit residence in the process of being renovated. Truck 818 and E8114 arrived next, and crews pulled a hose line and set up large volume deck mounted nozzles and quickly initiated fire attack. B8104 requested a second alarm upon initial radio report, and two more engines came to the scene along with three additional chief officers. Two coverage engines were requested, and they ran medical calls and other alarms while the fire was being extinguished. Additionally, City Ambulance provided a standby unit, and PGE Gas and Electric responded to the scene to evaluate utilities. End quote. KMUD talked with Timothy Citro, the fire chief with Humboldt Bay Fire, or HBF. He shared the timeline and response and how they were able to contain the fire.
Saturday morning at 1:20 a.m., we received a call of a structure fire in the area of 9th and H Streets. The first units arrived on scene, found heavy smoke and fire starting to come from the second floor of what we know to be a two-story apartment building that is currently under renovation. Within 2 minutes of arriving on scene, the fire flashed on the entire second floor and fully engulfed the second floor due to the fact that there was no sheetrock or any type of protective fire material on the second or first floor because the building was under renovation. So it was basically just open studs and open walls through the entire building. We initiated what we call a defensive attack, where we attacked the fire from the exterior and protected neighboring buildings. And the fire took about a half an hour to bring under control and was fully extinguished within 3 to 4 hours.
Even with the quick response, HBF was unable to save the building from collapsing, leading to it being demolished.
Our building was fully involved with fire. After the fire was extinguished in consultation with the city of Eureka's chief building official, the building was structurally unstable, so it had to be brought down to the ground. We never entered the building due to its structural instability because there was open framing that was all burned through and ceilings and the walls were caving, were starting to bow and showed signs of collapse.
The cause of the fire is still under investigation, but firefighters were able to contain the fire, stopping it from spreading to neighboring buildings. There were no civilian or firefighter injuries during this fire, and the damage is estimated around $350,000. Anyone with knowledge of the cause of the fire is encouraged to call the Eureka Police Department's non-emergency number at 707-441-4060. Two arrested during the Eureka ICE protests last weekend. Laura Montagna, the public information officer for the Eureka Police Department, has more.
This is Laura Montagna from the Eureka Police Department. Recent protests result in two arrests. The Eureka Police Department monitored two large protests that took place at the Humboldt County Courthouse on January 30th and 31st. While both protests were primarily peaceful, two separate incidents occurred that resulted in two arrests. January 30th, 2026 incident. On January 30th at approximately 4:56 p.m., an EPD officer monitoring protest activity near the intersection of 5th and J Streets observed a vehicle pull onto the sidewalk, after which a male exited the vehicle and entered the crowd. The officer responded into the crowd, located the male on the ground, and detained him in handcuffs. Based on the information known to the officer at the time, including the officer's observations and witness statements, Gary Beckett, age 71 of Eureka, was arrested for fighting in public. During the course of the investigation, additional information surfaced regarding events that preceded Beckett parking his vehicle and entering the crowd. The investigating officer later learned that a subject attending the protest had stepped off the sidewalk, assaulted Beckett, and stole his hat while Beckett was stopped at a red light at 5th and J Streets. Beckett reported that he parked his vehicle and entered the crowd in an attempt to recover his property. Beckett was arrested and booked into the Humboldt County Jail for fighting in public. The investigating officer has preliminarily identified a person of interest related to the assault and theft. If positively identified as the suspect, a report will be prepared and forwarded to the Humboldt County District Attorney's Office for review and potential charges. January 31st, 2026 incident. On January 31st, at approximately 1:34 p.m., EPD officers patrolling on bicycles witnessed a confrontation between a motorist and several protesters on the sidewalk at 5th Street between H and I Streets. It appeared to officers that the driver, the sole occupant of the vehicle, had sprayed protesters with a chemical agent. Officers conducted a traffic stop and detained the driver without incident. The investigation determined that the driver, Joseph Howe, 51, of Eureka, became involved in a verbal altercation with several individuals attending the protest who were on the sidewalk. During the altercation, Howe brandished a large can of chemical agent toward the group. While some individuals believe the spray may have been deployed, the investigation confirmed it was brandished only and not discharged. Howe was arrested and booked into the Humboldt County Jail for brandishing a weapon, assault, and illegal possession of a tear gas weapon. Anyone with information regarding either incident is encouraged to contact the Eureka Police Department at 707-441-4300.
For more information, visit their website, eurekaca.gov/police-department. Last week, the Sheriff's Department arrested Troy Robert Spencer, who was arrested for threatening his neighbor with a gun and firing several shots after walking away from the residence. Aaron Inskip, the Public Information Specialist for the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, shared more on this arrest.
On January 30th at approximately 5:41 a.m., Humboldt County Sheriff deputies were dispatched to a disturbance and a shots fired report occurred in the 200 block of Orchard Way at Myers Flat. When deputies arrived, they contacted the reporting party, who reported a neighbor, identified as 48-year-old Troy Robert Spencer, showed up to her residence with a rifle, made threatening statements, and then fired off several shots after walking away from the residence. Through witness statements and video surveillance of the incident, deputies located Spencer nearby and took him into custody without incident. Deputies learned that Spencer was also a convicted felon. They obtained a search warrant for Spencer's residence and seized numerous firearms and ammunition. Spencer was transported to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where he's booked on the following charges: PC 29800, felon in possession of firearms; PC 30305, prohibited person in possession of ammunition; PC 30605, illegally possess any assault weapon; PC 417, exhibit a firearm; PC 21510, carry or possess a switchblade knife. Anyone with information about this case or related criminal activity is encouraged to call the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 445-7251 or our crime tip line at 268-2539.
For more information, visit the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at humboldtgov.org/2545/sheriffs-office. Turning to Mendocino, the Mendocino Land Trust came to an agreement to protect 219 acres of forest along the Eel River. On February 2nd, 2026, Mendocino Land Trust, or MLT, announced they had finally come to an agreement on the Windswept Ranch conservation easement, protecting 219 acres of forest along the Eel River near Willits. K-Mud talked with Matt Franks, the land protection manager at Mendocino Land Trust. He shared the path to finally come to this agreement.
Mendocino Land Trust staff initially talked to the property owner in the late 90s about protecting the property. And so, yeah, it's been, you know, one of those projects that just takes a long time and has seen many iterations, and we're happy to see it wrapping up and to see the property protected. And, you know, I think the positive way to look at it is that it shows perseverance on everybody's side, on the part of the landowner, the original landowner, and now the new landowners, and several generations of MLT staff members who have kind of shepherded this project through a lot of obstacles and unforeseen, you know, problems. And we've made it through, so it feels really good to be complete and have it done.
Franks explained what exactly a conservation easement is. It is the complex legal tool to ensure the land remains exactly as it is.
The conservation easement basically is an agreement between a landowner and a land trust where the land is protected forever from being split up and subdivided and sold off, from being built up too much. And it basically just is a way for somebody to continue to own their land, but to protect it forever for wildlife habitat and open space and for agricultural purposes and all of those kind of values that are really core to Mendocino Land Trust mission.
He went into more detail about the agreement, talking about the process and how this agreement will protect this land and prevent it from being split up in the future.
The property can't ever be split up and sold separately, so it will always be one 220-acre property. There is a limited area of 10 acres where whatever the current or future owners can build, you know, recreational structures or build a cabin or something like that, right? Something minimal. And there's, you know, a square foot limit of how much, you know, can be built within that 10 acres. And outside of that, you know, no permanent structures, no new roads, no commercial timber harvesting, lots of sort of, you know, restrictions like that. And obviously, you know, no dumping of hazardous materials. You know, there's some things that are just definitely always included in a conservation easement like that.
Franks explained MLT's approach to conservation easements after they have been agreed upon.
We also go out once a year and we enforce, or we monitor and if necessary enforce, you know, all of our conservation easements. So every conservation easement we hold, privately owned land, but in the agreement it says we have the right to go out once a year, and more often if necessary, if there's a problem, you know, or a violation of the terms of the easement. And so that's a big part of our job. And yeah, you know, so that's how we make sure that landowners stick to what they agreed to, and that's also how we make sure that future landowners also stick to the terms. Because it's, you know, attached to the property deed, it's like any other kind of easement. Like if you have a road easement through your property that allows your neighbors to pass through, you can't just take that away, you know, if you're a new owner. That goes with the property, right? It's on the deed. And so the same thing goes with the conservation easement. No future owner of the property can just get rid of it or make any changes to it. It's permanent. It's forever. It's on the deed of the property. And so it's for perpetuity, and we have committed also to, again, going out there once a year and monitoring it in perpetuity. And we also, you know, have a stewardship endowment that, you know, is big enough that it pays for our staff to go out there where we sort of calculate how much we need for each property to make sure that it will grow enough that it will last forever, so that we can always pay our staff to go out there and, if necessary, you know, enforce and take legal action if there's a serious violation.
With this agreement, the property owner can still live on the land. They just have to abide by set rules that were in the agreement.
In this case, there's certain things that the property owner can do without letting us know, but there's a lot of things that they have to do either by letting us know. You know, so if they're going to build a cabin out there, they've got to give us notice. And you know, if they're going to do too much more than that, they have to ask our approval. And so that, you know, at that point, whoever, you know, is on our staff will, you know, take all of the factors into consideration in that request and make sure that the, you know, request to build or whatever it is that the landowner wants to do does not substantively harm the wildlife habitat on the property or, you know, anything else that the easement is there to protect. And so that's a really, you know, important way that we kind of continually have some back and forth with the landowners about, you know, allowing them to do what they, you know, should be able to do with their own property, but, you know, within those restrictions so that we make sure that the habitat is all protected. And that's especially important with this conservation easement since it is on the Eel River, which is just such an important, you know, habitat for salmon, and so many other species, we really want to make sure that, you know, as much of the watershed is protected. And so, again, we're really happy that, you know, this deal is closed and that we feel like we reached an agreement that, you know, really, really robustly protects the forest, but also, really importantly, the Eel River and the watershed.
The timing of this agreement was perfect. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Mendocino Land Trust. It has grown into a countywide organization that managed 36 conservation easements and almost 100 public access trails along the coast. While much of their work is focused on the coastline, Frank's talked about how they are expanding inland.
We're especially looking to expand public access in inland Mendocino County, where there's just not as many trails and not as many, you know, public spaces. So we're really excited. We're building the one segment of the Great Redwood Trail, which is going to run from downtown Willits up north along Highway 101 for about 15 miles. And we've started the planning for that. And it's going to be a long process, but we're excited to be doing more work inland.
For Franks, working with MLT is a dream come true.
I was born and raised in Mendocino County, and I went away for 20 years for education and various jobs, and I've lived a lot of different places all over the country, from the Midwest to the East Coast to the South, kind of all over. And I came back about 5 years ago, and I'm really just so thankful to be doing this work here in Mendocino County, because of all the places I've lived, it has changed the least, you know, in terms of development. I just saw so many other places, and I've seen so many other places just boom with housing developments and condos and, you know, really change in their character and scenery and all of that. And so I think it's important that we protect what we have now, because while it hasn't changed as much as many other places, you know, it will eventually. And so I think that's why I'm really motivated to do this kind of work. And so circling back to, you know, this specific project, it's incredibly remote. You know, it's hard to get to. You have to kayak across the Eel River, you know, to get there. There's no roads that go there. So, you know, the threat of development there is pretty minimal currently. But I think it's really important to protect properties like this, because eventually they will be under threat of development. And it's so important that we have that long time frame, you know, in terms of the work we do in this county, because we are still really remote. We're still really rugged. You know, it's still a really rural, scenic, beautiful county. And so, again, personally, I'm really, you know, fulfilled and happy to be doing this work where I came from. And in terms of this project, I think this is, you know, like I said in the quote, it's one piece, you know, of the larger work that we do. And what's great about Winthrop Ranch, too, is that it is kind of a connector between two other conservation areas out there east of Willits. So those are, you know, high priorities for us, because it creates a wildlife kind of passage, you know, through. And because the work we do is forever, you know, we can't ever rest easy, because we always have to, you know, be continuing to do the work of conservation and stewardship. But, you know, I think it's good at times like this, once we've closed the project, especially a project that's taken this long, to feel good about an accomplishment like this, you know, because we have filled in a piece of the puzzle of land conservation in our wild and scenic and beautiful rural county, because we want to keep it that way. As much as I will also say, you know, we also are thinking and talking and working more and more, you know, to recognize that that work has to go along with supporting affordable housing. Because, you know, if we protected the entire county, you know, then there's nowhere for people to build houses, and that's a huge priority. So we're also more cautious, you know, about those kind of issues these days than I think maybe we used to be.
For more information about this project, visit MLT's website, mendocinolandtrust.org. In national news, Dems insisting on ICE reforms as Republicans hope for quick vote to end partial government shutdown. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The debate over the partial government shutdown and funding for Immigration and Customs Enforcement has moved to the House of Representatives, where Democrats are demanding changes to ICE enforcement. Democrat Hakeem Jeffries is the House Minority Leader.
Nobody is above the law. ICE officers should be held to the same standards as every other member of law enforcement in the country who put their lives on the line for us. Law enforcement officers, police officers at home in New York and across the country. And ICE needs to be reined in. They're out of control. They need to be brought to heel so that there is a level of accountability and professionalism that the American people are demanding.
President Donald Trump struck a deal last week with senators to separate funding for the Department of Homeland Security from a broader budget package after public outrage over two shooting deaths during protests in Minneapolis. Under the plan approved by the Senate, the Department of Homeland Security would be funded temporarily until February 13th, setting up a deadline for Congress to try to find consensus on new restrictions on ICE operations. Jeffries says Democrats have the high ground on the issue, and without dramatic changes to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, a full-year appropriation is in deep trouble.
And so Democrats are committed to this fight. And again, we've made clear, line in the sand, red line, we've articulated the things that will be necessary for there to be a full-year appropriations bill connected to ICE funding, because we're standing on the side of the American people, some of whom have been killed in cold blood by ICE in plain sight, horrifying the American people.
Among the changes that Democrats want in ICE legislation are an end to roving patrols in cities, a halt to the detention and deportation of U.S. citizens, and an enforceable code of conduct for federal agents. They also want a requirement that agents unmask, something Republicans largely oppose. Another demand is that agents wear body cameras. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem announced Monday that agents in Minneapolis will be issued body cameras, with other regions to be added as funding permits. But some critics are wary of that proposal, noting fears over selective release of body camera footage. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump has weighed in, urging Congress to approve the Senate-passed measure without change. Republicans are hoping to bring it to a vote as soon as Tuesday, though that may be more easily said than done. Right now, the measure is in committee. Republican Steve Scalise is the House Majority Leader.
We always work till the midnight hour to get the votes, and, you know, you never start the process with everybody on board. You work through it, and you could say that with every major bill we pass.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Ojibwe tribes and the Great Lakes region are raising concerns about Trump administration plans to remove a rule that limits road building and national forest land. Chuck Kornbach has more.
The roadless rule is a U.S. Forest Service policy that for 25 years has curtailed building or reconstructing roads in the national forests. There have also been limits on commercial timber harvesting in roadless areas that have been inventoried. Last summer, the U.S. Agriculture Department, which includes the Forest Service, proposed rescinding the roadless rule. The department said that would give more decision-making authority to regional forest managers and improve access for fighting fires. But the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, which serves 11 Ojibwe tribes in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan that have treaty-protected hunting, fishing, and gathering rights, backs the roadless rule. Commission spokesperson Jenny Van Sickle says agency scientists looked at how the rule has protected five national forests in what's called the ceded territory. She says the federal government has a responsibility to enforce treaty rights there.
That's wild rice. That's tapping maples for sap to make, you know, sugar. These are real activities. They're not theoretical. These are federal responsibilities that remain in place. So to try to kick that to regional foresters doesn't make a lot of sense.
Van Sickle says there are already many roads in the national forests. She says if the roadless rule needs amending, the tribes are willing to talk.
If the rule needs work, you know, we want to be at those tables. We want to talk about those problems. We want to get to those solutions. And we can do that together. We've worked very closely and formally with the Forest Service for nearly 30 years.
An Agriculture Department spokesperson says the agency remains committed to a consultation process with the tribes. Also, that if the roadless rule ends, land use decisions would still need to comply with specific forest or grassland management plans and other applicable laws, all developed with public involvement. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Tribal leaders respond to Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt's final State of the State address, which he delivered Monday. Tribal leaders say Stitt misrepresents tribes. Tribes and the governor have had a rocky relationship, including disagreements over jurisdiction, gaming, and other issues. In his speech, Stitt said all laws should apply equally to all Oklahomans. Stitt said, quote, "Many of us in this room have decried the DEI programs of the Biden administration, yet stand by quietly when someone says an Indian should be subject to a different set of laws." Choctaw Nation Chief Gary Batten in a statement said tribes and tribal members have sovereign rights, which are not based on race, but treaties and other agreements between tribal nations and the U.S. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. said in a statement that the governor effectively called for the termination of tribal government, calling it rhetoric cloaked in references to DEI and race. Hoskin said, fortunately, Stitt spoke to a bipartisan chamber. Both leaders say they look forward to working with the legislature and other elected officials. A number of tribal leaders attended the address. The Interior Department has added the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina to the official list of federally recognized tribes, formalizing the tribe's government-to-government relationship with the U.S. The agency published the updated list in the Federal Register following President Donald Trump's signing of legislation in December, granting federal recognition status to the Lumbee Tribe. The list consists of 575 American Indian and Alaska Native tribal entities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.